they're okay. So with that, I'm going to introduce Mr. Snarky. I love how he does the bite. Did you see the bite thing last night? Did you just see that? Yeah. Glenn, thanks for being here.
Sure.
Give him a welcome.
Okay, housekeeping, Dick. We didn't talk about this. Our shutoff time for this session is?
Whenever you're done.
Wow. Okay, we will break after the first session at 1:30, just so that you know. No, thank you. This talk this morning, whoop. There we go. That's better. Thank you very much. Dick and I went out to dinner last night afterwards, and there's no reason for me to tell you this, but just that it was yummy. I had French toast at Cracker Barrel, and it was absolutely God's will to have done that. I have never sensed God's... I had two of those little bottles. And you know what? They were the kind of little bottles, if you know the movie Elf, where he's down in the mailroom. Oh, you like syrup too? They were like those little kind of whiskey bottle kind of things. That's why I asked for two of them. And they turned out to be syrup. So anyway, which was not bad, but it was very, very good. The talk that I am going to give this morning is a little different than last night, not just in topic, but in seriousness. Because last night we were talking about ideology. I say ideology, but ideology, and I don't mean it idiot, it's just that's the way I pronounce it. We were talking about ideology last night, and the way that I approach this issue, and we're going to talk about this in the second session this morning, is when you're talking about the issue, you can just swing freely and just say what you need to say. When you're talking about people, you are gracious, honorable, compassionate. Why? Because these are people. Somebody came through there last night. That's the freakiest thing in the world. That's the Holy Spirit, just so that we...
Right.
Exactly. He's going to stick his head out. So what we're talking about this morning is situations with people. And we are talking about the idea and the ideology, but it's interesting for me that with many times same-sex attracted people, that you can have just... of course, normal, regular people who are just trying to live their lives, kind of like we talked about last night. But then you can have some very angry, mean people. I have never, ever, ever met a mean or angry transgender person. I just never have. They tend to be very tender in their heart, very gracious. Very, very vulnerable. And it has to do, and I don't mean this ugly, but it really has to do with the condition. And for us to know that, okay, this, we can't, you know, the LGBT thing, and we're going to talk about this, we can't clump all those people together because they're different things. And I want to talk about, in the second session, the G's and the L's, the lesbians and the gays. Lesbian and gay, male and female, same-sex attraction, are far more different than they are similar. And that is because there's a female nature and a male nature, and they experience these things differently. And so we can't think, well, they're all the same. And the transgender folks, they are just of a whole different group. And I mean this seriously, is when I interact with them, you just want to give them a hug and hold them and just tell them it's going to be okay. I mean, that's the spirit that I get from them, is they just need to be told that things are going to be fine, you know. And even if you will, and this may hit some of you differently, is, and I don't use the word play, but play along with them nicely as individuals, you know? Well, don't you need to make a stand? You need to make a stand in culture, but for the individual, you know what? That's just not the way to win them is, I'm not going to call you what you want me to call you. It's like, you know what? For the heart-to-heart connection, just play along with them. You can keep your conviction, but as I like to say, and I don't mean this sarcastic, if you meet somebody and they think that they are Ernest Hemingway, you'll play along with them. You know, what novels are you working on? You know, it's just, you just do that, right? And you're not, you know, giving up anything. But so there are these complexities here, and particularly with transgender people, they have a different heart. They have a different sensitivity. They have a different struggle going on within them. So you need to, again, God creates everybody in this room as a unique being, and He delights in them as a unique being. And even the struggles that the transgender person, God as a parent, just like we do with our kids, like, you know what? Hang in there. I'm trying to reach you. I'm trying to help you. We need to have that same heart as well. So I want to move in to talk about the transgender issue and how it functions as an ideology. What does the research say about how we interact with kids that are gender dysphoric? And then what do we know causes this? Because as we're out in the culture, people will tell us, oh, we know exactly what this is. It's the way the person is. But let's look at the people who are real clinicians studying this stuff, who are not necessarily conservatives or in our camp, but they're just honest about what the research says. So we're going to explore that as well. So the title of this talk is Mrs. Jenner question mark, and it really is remarkable. Here's Mrs. Jenner here, and we talked last night about just the hyper stereotypicality, if you will, of Bruce on that cover. And most women will see that and just go, you know what? I mean, she's not even trying to be a woman, you know, but this stereotype of what we think a woman is. But in all these cover stories, in all these magazines, I think it's died down a little bit, but trans was the new orange, you know, of that that show. It just, it was the big, big thing. And we honored people like that, and we celebrated that kind of thing. So we need to know about it. We need to know what the nature is. The question is just, what's the deal here? And we need to be able to address this, again, in compassion, but not play along with the foolishness in the public realm in this way. Underlying beliefs, and a good bit of this we talked about last night, but these underlying beliefs of gender theory, which allow us as a culture to accept this idea that people can claim their own gender. And let me say this, first of all, is, and I don't think I said this last night, but according to orthodox gender theory, again, paying attention in class, that I literally, in this talk now, could change my gender 6 times as I'm giving the talk in my head, and at the end of the talk, I don't know what I'll come out as, but nobody can argue that my process of changing my gender that many times in my talk is illegitimate. I have asked folks from the other side, and you know, I talked last night, we'll have these people to focus to come and connect, and we'll talk. You mentioned Matthew Vines. I've had Matthew to focus, and you know, we've had these little roundtable discussions, and really good. And I asked one of them, I said, that question, you know, I said, we're walking from this building over to that building. By the time I get there, what if I had changed my gender? And I truly believed that I did. What would you say? And I expected her to say, well, it's a little more complicated than that, you know, which, yeah. She goes, if that's your story, I would have to respect it. I mean, just remarkable. But it fits because it's in here. And now we think many times, like with Bruce Jenner, I would have people ask me, okay, she's becoming a woman. And they will say, I will say, you know what, he hasn't had his south of the border surgery. And they're like, how can that be? How can he be a woman and not have had that surgery? And like, oh, you poor little soul, you haven't been paying attention in class. You know, you're so naive. That in a sense, I, according to gender theory, I can tell you that I am a woman. Well, you aren't kind of transing to a woman. The trans happens up here. If you say, Glenn, why aren't you making any adjustment to look like a woman? I can say, well, please tell me what a woman looks like. Meaning, try to fit me into the stereotype of what a woman is. And the gender theorist would have to, oh, okay, that's right. You know, I can't put my understanding of what a female is upon you. If I think this is what a female looks like, then this is what a female looks like to me. And so that's kind of the problem with the Target bathroom thing and that kind of stuff. You know, there are trans people who come into our bathrooms, and you know what? For all intents and purposes, that's a woman. They go into the stall, or, you know, there's just not a problem because they're kind of playing along by the rules in that way, and they don't make a big deal about it. But according to real trans theory, I could walk into the Target bathroom, woman's bathroom like this, and according to gender theory, there ain't nobody anything can say. And Target learned that. You know, and like, oh my goodness. Very much like Facebook did, and the 52 different genders, like, okay, there aren't really hard and fast rules there. They would think that the trans people would play by the rules, and in many ways, the trans people do play by the rules in that way. You know what? I identify as a woman. I want to go into the woman's bathroom. They don't mean anything bad by it. But there are people who do not, and it's not just the pervy types, you know? Like, you know what? I am going to send a message to the culture that you have to see me as a woman, even as I look like this, or a woman as a man. There are no real objective rules because, again, it exists up here. And nobody can tell me otherwise, according to gender theory. So let's run through these things real quick. Underlying beliefs that male and female are social constructs, that they can flow and they're fluid and they can change. Sex and gender are different things. We talked about that last night. That gender is fluid, that it's a spectrum, again, that thing, and that binary is a naughty word. When we get rid of these things and say these things don't matter, then it opens up all kinds of different possibilities. So we need to ask, what is it to be transgender? This is the definition, is simply when one's subjective identity, and they use the word subjective, okay, I was assigned male at birth, but that's not actually who I am. I was assigned that way according to somebody else's criteria of what a male or female is, and that is different than one's natal sex. And so again, gender is up here, sex is down here, this is objective. Everybody can refer to that, but that's, if you will, the illusion. It's up here that's really real for them. They're turning just reality absolutely on its head. And as we're going to see in a minute, there is no science, no science whatsoever. In fact, it's contradictory or reverse that says, oh no, this is the legitimate part up here. It's contrary to science. Okay. Kind of what we talked about last night in the male and female are gender or constructs, social constructs. But if you are a trans male or female, then no, your male and femaleness is legitimate. This, the director of programs At GLAAD. They are an organization that makes sure that the media and things does well by the gay community. He says, the world can now see what Caitlyn Jenner has always known, that she is and always has been a woman. Again, there's that thing of Bruce was a socially constructed male, but now his femaleness is no actually who he is. You guys can't have it both ways, right? Which one is it? But this is what we're seeing. Is this different than intersex? And this is very, very, very important. In the next talk, I'm going to talk about the alphabet soup thing. And there's an I in that alphabet soup of LGBTQQAAI, blah, 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 blah. The I is for intersex. But intersex is different than transgender because it is an objective, measurable, observable thing. Intersex refers to an objective physical reality where one is born with ambiguous genitalia or mixed chromosomes. It's something that, as I like to say, scientists can observe it under a microscope. They can look at it. And another scientist comes along and says, oh yes, I concur. I mean, you can see it. You can, it's objective. And this is just ambiguous genitalia or chromosomal situation that's just not quite right. Now, this is certainly not a third, fourth, or fifth gender. It's just the body hasn't developed as it normally does. And it's kind of cool. We have a little Indian girl in our neighborhood, and she has six toes on one foot, and she's super proud of it. She wears, I mean, it really is. Have I shown you my sixth toe? We don't look at her and think, well, she's a different kind of human because she's got another toe. No, sometimes the body doesn't do what the body normally does. In fact, every single human being, the body doesn't do what the body is supposed to do. We all have these little weird quirks. Some of them are more dramatic than others, like myself. You can tell what those things are, maybe. And it's interesting, if you want to go to graduate studies on this in this class, look at the Intersex Association of North America. I think that's the name of it. But it's the organization that exists to help parents and individuals come to terms with being intersex. What's interesting is that organization is not politically conservative, but they're ideologically conservative. They are not activists. They just, you know what, this is the situation. Let's not buy into all this other stuff. Let's just look at the situation and make decisions for our children based on what we know. And they have a little Q&A, and they say, absolutely, intersex is not a third, fourth, or fifth gender. It's just not. It's a developmental thing of the body. It just is. And again, you don't really find, you do sometimes, but in the alphabet and the I in there, you don't have intersex people typically showing up to the LGBT meetings. Because they don't see themselves as something different. They're just trying to come to terms with who they are and doing the best that they can. So it's not a radical other kind of thing, even according to the intersex people themselves. That's important for us to know, that intersex is very different than trans. So what causes gender identity disorder? And this is important, GID as the clinicians call it, gender identity disorder. And the DSM, who, you know, the Bible for clinicians, just recently changed it to gender dysphoria because they didn't like the disorder word. And you think about this, okay, I mean, who wants to be identified with, oh, you know, I'm such and such and I have a disorder? But is dysphoria any better, really? And we'll do these things in the culture like, well, at least it's not a disorder, it's a dysphoria. Well, dysphoria means you're confused, you know? I don't think anybody, I'd rather be confused than have a disorder, you know? But, you know, we play along and we, but gender identity disorder, the clinicians don't really call it trans. They call it objectively what it is. It is a lack of connection between your physicality and your understanding of yourself. Bottom line, folks, is nobody knows what causes it or contributes to it. I wrote a booklet on this topic for an organization in New Zealand about 2 years ago, and you can find it. It's the PDF of it is online. And when I'm looking for it, I just search Glenn T. Stanton, Family First, and then Boys, Girls, Others. And you'll see there's a executive summary PDF, and then there's the full report. And I have a section in there where I investigate this question of, according to the best secular academic research and studies, I never base my research on newspaper articles or popular articles in Time or Newsweek. Always go to the respected mainstream academic journal articles. And these people, the leading clinicians, just say, we just simply don't know. But when you're out in the culture, you'll hear, oh, no, no, we absolutely do know. It's that you can be born in a boy body and have a female brain. I've been on the Dr. Phil show two times. On this topic. And, you know, the doctor, the clinician from UCLA, who is a major brain scientist, I mean, I know of his work, but he just comes out and he says, oh, no, we know that a male body can be born with a female brain. And like, I'm the Yahoo from Focus. I mean, like, I don't have a PhD or anything. And I am the one who has to tell him that he's wrong. But like, you know what? I know that he's wrong because I've looked at the literature and like, you know, dude, simply, you know better than this, or you should know better than this. And I want to show you some of the quotes and some of the conclusions from scholars in this area. Kenneth Zucker, he is a clinician up in Canada, and he is a secularist, has very salty language, but he does not put up with this mess and bunk at all. He just skewers it. In fact, the trans community actually came after him with great ferocity and really just has, he's persona non grata now in this community. Not because of anything that he's done, and he used to be well respected, and he really is by other clinicians, but they have just slimed him so bad. He was picked as one of the people to study gender identity disorder or contribute. In fact, he was the leader of the group of clinicians to determine how gender identity disorder should be described in the DSM. I mean, he's a major player. And so he says, in terms of empirical data, it is not true that this exists in the...
Sorry. Please use that.
Okay, thank you. Sorry. In terms of the empirical data, it is just simply not true that this exists in the male or female brain. It's just dogma, and I've never liked dogma. Biology is not destiny. He says, you know, this issue is more complex than the general theory of this. I love this one, too, and this is, you know, a journal, journal article, letter to the editor from somebody, and is gender identity disorder adolescents coming out of the closet? They kind of say, you know, they ask the question, what's happening? And this one, it's Zucker and a bunch of others. And they saw that in the literature, you know, people were going, oh, no, we absolutely know what this is. He says, no, me along with a number of my colleagues, because the etiology, the cause of GID is still largely a matter of speculation. It's another word for saying we just don't know. This is another one, and I love this. These two clinicians they run a big center for gender dysphoria for kids, a clinic helping kids understand this, in Amsterdam. That's not the Amsterdam in Mississippi, where they're very conservative and traditional. This is the Amsterdam, where they're very free-thinking, and they really accept nearly anything. But these two clinicians have remarkable views, and they really do have the views or the conclusions that we largely have in this room, practicing in Amsterdam. And in fact, they just edited a book. It's in 2014, and I think I make reference to it, but it's treating the transgender patient. And I'll tell you what they say in there. But they say in this article, the clinical management of gender dysphoria in children and adolescents, the Dutch approach. How do we handle this in our Dutch model? They say no unequivocal ideology, again, a cause, factor determining atypical gender developments has been found to date. Okay, my opponent on the Dr. Phil show who says, oh no, we know what this is. You know what? There are a number of high power colleagues of yours who say that is simply not true. And so we need to have that kind of confidence. It is most likely a multifactorial condition in which psychosocial as well as biological aspects play some sort of role. So what they're saying is, first of all, we don't know, and it is most likely, okay, so in terms of clinical language, this says, we don't know, but we would assume, and there's a humility in that, right? We would assume that it is some sort of thing happening in the brain, but also something biologically inside that is sort of driving this. And we need to understand this, that there are lots of biological drives and urges within us, but just because it's biological, we don't mean it's, well, who I am, and it's a good thing. I have suffered from depression really all my life. And nobody goes, well, I'm just a depressed person. Okay, well, we'll accept you as a depressed person. We go, you know what, why don't you do something about it? You know, why don't you make some adjustments there? And so biology is not always necessarily natural or just the way we go with things and accept things. This guy right here, J. Michael Bailey, he teaches at Northwestern in Chicago. He is an activist in the gay community and an activist scholar. But what is interesting is he many times doesn't sit well within the gay community because he just tells it like it is, both ways. And he'll shut us down and he'll shut his own community down when he detects just BS, you know, from folks. And he says, and this is a study that came out in 2007, what many transgender activists don't want you to know and why you should know it anyway. Again, knowing where he comes from, he's just being honest. Currently, the predominant cultural understanding is that transsexuals are essentially women trapped in men's bodies. This understanding has little scientific basis. However, and is inconsistent with clinical observations. He's a clinician. Therefore, the persistence of the predominant cultural understanding is damaging to science and to many transsexuals. Okay, so when we say, you know, yeah, the science out there and what scientists are saying, we don't really accept that and we think it's damaging. Well, you guys just go back to your church and your Bible study. You really don't understand these things. No, we're in line with some other mainstream thinkers who are very friendly to gay ideology and theory. And Michael Bailey is one of those. Now, this is very, very important. And this is when we hear, you know, in your local school that this little child, 8 years old, is they wouldn't say gender dysphoric. They would say this little boy is actually a little girl and we've all got to play along and that this is a thing. This research right here, and this is from the same people at the Amsterdam Clinic, they are looking at what the clinicians call desisting and persisting gender dysphoria after childhood. And this is a broad range survey of all the literature. The desisting and the persisting is my gender dysphoria as an 8 year old. They want to know, is it persisting into adolescence or am I desisting? Have I kind of straighten myself out just through life? And what they find out is up to 98% of gender dysphoric children desist by puberty. The scale they find out is about from 78 or 82 to 98% of kids who, when they are prepubescent, that say, I'm a little girl and I want to, you know, change my room and I want to wear sparkly things and I want people to recognize me at school as this, up to 98%, 82, 98% of those kids, by the time they hit puberty, are not going to feel that way about themselves. Okay? If it really is a thing that is wired within them, if that little boy actually has a female brain, then what happened in those intervening years to have them switch over? My colleague on Dr. Phil, you know what? You haven't considered this. You know, most of it is not anything that's really happening with their body. It's in here. They have a different understanding of themselves. And I said in my first appearance on the Dr. Phil show, I said, one of the cool things about being a little kid is you can be most anything you want to be. And you don't know what you are. And there's a wonder in that, you know? I said to that crowd, I said, literally, when I was a kid, my parents told me I could be anything. And I took them at their word. And I told them I wanted to be a horse. And I really did. I mean, like, look at the way they gallop, their manes, you know, flapping in the wind, and a cowboy will ride you. You know, like, if I can be anything, that's what I want to be. And guess what? I grew out of that. You know, that's what kids do. I grew out of it 4 years into my marriage. It's funny that my wife stuck with me, even though I still maintained that. Likely reasons for desisting. And I talk about this in this, and the people that did that work on the clinical approach from the Amsterdam, from the Netherlands model, this is what they're saying, that there are a number of reasons why kids just straighten themselves out. Or, you know, I kind of like when your car's swerving and you just kind of let off the, it'll just, you know, correct itself. That's sort of what these kids do. One is later on in third, fourth, fifth grade, when the sexes start to segregate themselves, you know, the boys over here, the girls over here, they connect. The little boy or the little girl, they're like, you know what? I think I identify over here. Even though I'm not like the rest of the boys, my body, and they just kind of start gravitating over this way. Not all of them do, but a great number of them do. And so they start to identify as they mature and grow with what they actually are. The other is they're changing bodies. Okay? When I'm a little kid, there's nothing really going on inside of me, hormonally and physically. But as my body starts to change, wow, I'm feeling like a little boy. You know, I'm feeling like a little girl. And so just nature is sort of driving them in that way. The other is falling in love. It's the sexual attraction. Well, I'm a little boy who thinks I'm a girl, but you know what? I like girls. and all the other boys like girls. So I'm kind of being pulled over in this direction. And again, they don't know why these things are the causes, but they're ascertaining that in their clinics, they're kind of seeing these things. And so there are these things that just kind of happen in life by the time these kids hit puberty that they kind of straighten themselves out. And life just straightens them out. Okay, so what do the experts recommend? And what do the experts with the Dutch model recommend? According to the Dutch approach, and I always put the page citations, not that you're going to look it up right now, but you know, here's the citation. It's in volume 59. Here are the page numbers. You know what? Go look it up. And so when I'm speaking to hostile audiences, you know what? You guys go look it up. And the cool thing about it is you can find these things on your iPhone. And I have people in the audience who will look it up. And they'll go, well, I don't see that on page 307. Look down at the bottom where it flips over to 308, and you'll see in that last sentence there. And they're like, how does this guy know this? You know, because you got to look at the original. You can't ever quote or cite what somebody else said, even though that person is reasonable. Go look at the thing itself, and that gives you the confidence. And so I'll go, no, keep scrolling down that page. See that last sentence there that, you know, and they're like, okay, wow, it is there. What they say in the Dutch model is do not play along and help the child change their identity to the other gender. If you've got a little boy who thinks they're a little girl, they say in the Amsterdam model, do not change their room. Do not let them change their dress. Do not let them change their name. You can make some little subtle things, and they'll say, you know what, if your little boy wants to play with a My Little Pony, let him have one or two, but only play with it at home, not out there. So what they're saying is give them a little bit of outlet here, but don't let the full weight of their identity and life go here. Keep it what their natal gender is. Why? Because it is overwhelmingly likely that they are going to desist. And if you've changed their room, and this is what they say. This is what they say. And a number of the mainline clinicians say, absolutely, even the gay-friendly ones do. That if you change the room, change their name, change their dress, change their identity in school, change everything about it, and you as the parents start playing along with this, well, when they hit the age of 8 and they're like, and they start to desist, maybe I'm not this way, the clinicians will tell you, but there has been so much momentum and we have changed reality to facilitate my earlier understanding. And the clinicians will say, there's one of them that just says it very frankly in an Atlantic Monthly article. He goes, that's a, quote, that's a hell of a lot of pressure for an 8-year-old child to rise above to say, I want to go back to what I was. And they say, the adults on the scene need to be the adults and know a couple years ahead, it's not going to be this way. So let's make the proper adjustments here. Be kind to it. Be, you know, yes, you can have your little Barbie doll and maybe you can, you know, dress up in your mermaid outfit at home, but not outside the home. But outside the home, we're going to be this. And they say that's just going to work out better later for the development of the child. Because again, the desisting is the overwhelming likelihood of what will happen. Now, when we're in a school situation and you go to the school meeting and we're talking about what are we going to do with the bathrooms and stuff, and you go, you know what? No, we're not going to play along with this. You will be marked as being bigoted, backwards, uncaring, and you can go, well, if I am, the people at the world-leading Amsterdam clinic are, and I would encourage you, Their textbook is expensive. Actually, you can read it online on Google Books. Google Books is an excellent thing because, like in Amazon, they will scan a good part of the book and you can go to these pages and read it. That's what I did in the research. And cite this. And the cool thing about it is that nobody in the audience that you're talking with has done this. And just because you know about this thing and you can print out the pages and show them, you know, they're like, okay, this person has gone way ahead of anything that we've ever done. Right? And that's a wonderful thing to be able to do. But no, it's not my backwoodness, Southern Baptist tradition, you know, that draws me to this conclusion. It might be, but it's in line with the leading clinicians in the world who work with kids day after day after day. So don't put that bigot label on me. And if you are, you're going to have to put it on these clinicians as well. Okay, so at Johns Hopkins was the first place, and I think I mentioned the name John Money last night. He was the really radical theorist who came up with a distinction between sex and gender, and he was the one that brought sex change operation work to Johns Hopkins. But there was another guy who came along, and he said, you know what, we're stopping this because it's just psychological madness, because having the surgery does not typically solve the problem. In fact, some of these studies, long-term follow-up of transsexual persons undergoing sex reassignment surgery, and this is a cohort in Sweden, in a place where the culture is trans-affirming, they say that post-surgery, after surgery, the need for psychological hospitalization, not just going in and seeing your counselor every once in a while or taking a, you know, a medication, but hospitalization is still three times greater than those who did. I can't remember if it's the normal population. I think so. You know, greater than the normal population. Post-surgery, 20 times higher suicide death rate, 5 times higher suicide risk rate. I had an activist tell me, well, but you've got to think about how much higher it would have been if they didn't have the surgery. Like, seriously, 20 times higher is good news? Oh yeah, we got it down to 20 times higher. No, I mean, that's just ridiculous. That the surgery, and there's some of the clinicians, some of the surgeons have said and remarked, and I have the quotes in there, you are calling upon us to cut on the body when you can't heal the mind. And you don't cut on healthy bodies. You know, they're physical people. The surgeons look at the body itself. And to call them to cut the body to fix something up there is completely contrary to what they understand themselves to be. It's a little bit like abortion in the medical community. There are people who do it, but they're sort of shunned in the medical community because, like, we don't operate on healthy, you know, healthy living beings. And that's how these people are. Post-surgical transsexuals are a risk group, this article concludes, and this is, they're saying this to clinicians, post-surgical transsexuals are a risk group that need long-term psychiatric and somatic follow-up. That this doesn't solve the problem. That it just kind of readjusts the problem. They may do a little bit better in their identity, but the underlying issues are still there. And increasingly, there are trans people who trans back because they understand and realize, you know what, it's hard to keep taking my hormones and, you know, those sorts of things. I want to just trans back and I'll live life that way. There was a scholar, and this is interesting, there was a scholar just very recently where he wanted to study trans folks who trans back. He was he was told by his university that he may not embark on that kind of research. Think about that. The chilling effect of academic inquiry. But that's what we're seeing today. And this guy wasn't an activist. It is a curious area of study. But they would not let him study that. I mean, that's where we're going, is, again, that sort of social fascism. We're at the university where all questions are open, and we will go where the truth leads us, except here, you know? And it is really surprising that other scholars aren't standing up and saying, okay, I'm just full on gay or full on trans, but wait a minute. This is going to set a, and that the ACLU doesn't step in on that, right? Because they believe in freedom of speech and intellectual freedom and things like that. Hold your breath on that one. Okay, now I'm going to end with this. And how are we doing on time, Dick?
5 minutes.
Okay, 5 minutes. We're cool. This is where things get very, very serious. That the trans thing used to be a pretty weird kind of thing. And that the trans person was sort of marked in society as kind of a weirdo. And, you know, well, they went to Trinidad in Colorado and they had the sex surgery and now they're back and oh my goodness. But now it's acceptable. In fact, it's actually kind of brave to do this. But what this is there's something happening in the brain, and the brain does not connect with what the body is, and so we adjust the body. And on the trans thing, we're just absolutely cool with this. But there is another psychological condition that is absolutely real, and it goes by two names, and there's a slight difference in terms of a sexual nature of it, but apototemnophilia and xenomelia is, and these are journal articles on this topic. Apototemnophilia, a neurological disorder, the desire for healthy limb amputation, structural brain correlates and clinical features of xenomenophilia. What it is, I mispronounced that, but what it is it's the understanding that here I am, and what these people will report, and I mean this, I mean, we're talking about people. This is very heartbreaking. That what their story is, and it's a common story, is that here's who I am, but my leg below the knee, they're very specific, okay? That it's usually, and oftentimes the right leg, curiously, below the knee does not belong to me. It is not my leg, okay? And sometimes, or, you know, my arm right halfway through here is not mine, and I need it cut off. And so the clinicians will tell us that what these individuals will do. And there's an article in this in the Atlantic Monthly, and it's called, the title is A New Way to Be Mad. And what these people will do is they will go out and they will place their leg under on a train track. Or they will have a chainsaw accident, you know? Or they will, one guy, he fashioned his own guillotine in his basement to have it cut off. And many times it's either to remove it or it's to mangle it so that the doctors will finally do, because you go to a doctor, you know what, this is not my leg, I need it cut off, will you please cut it off? You know, they will not do it. In fact, in the medical literature now, there are ethical articles on, is this an ethical thing to do? But they will mangle it so that it finally has to be amputated. Now think about this. The little girl who has six toes, okay, you know what? It's a weird kind of toe, but she thinks it's actually kind of cool, okay? And if you think, you know what, okay, like, no, this is not my hand, but I'm going to live with it. You know, it's not really about the thing. The drive to have this thing off to the fact that I would put it on a train track, the clinicians know, okay, this is not about the limb. In fact, there is a subset of that. This is serious. My leg below the knee is not mine. And this, I always use this illustration, I've just made it up. It belongs to a plumber that lives up in Montana. And they can tell you the whole story about the guy. They have created in their mind, or not created, it's in their mind, who this belongs to. You know, like, okay, this person needs to be in therapy. On the limb thing, that's just no question, right? But here's the difference. What's the difference there? One group, the gender group, has a lobby fighting for them. The limb folks do not. There's another thing here, and I'm going to finish with this. I just have some quotes here. They use the same language as the gender people. I've always felt that I should be an amputee. I've always felt this way, hence it's natural. I have felt this way, this is the way I was since birth. It feels the right way that I should have always been, and for some reason in line with what I think my body ought to have been like. These limb people are talking just like the gender people. Just as a transsexual is not happy with his own body but longs to have the body of another sex, I'm the same way. I'm wanting to have a peg leg. In fact, not only sometimes is it that they want the limb gone, they see themselves as, there's the phrase for it, is trans-abled. They see themselves as a disabled person. There's this woman. She is a scientist that works in a clinic of a public health place. I mean, she's a brilliant woman. She is able-bodied, but she has braces on her legs. She is in a wheelchair. Not because she just prefers that. She sees herself and understands herself as a disabled person. And get this, and it's not because she's just generally nuts. She has been looking for a long time for a surgeon to snap her spinal cord so that she will actually be what she understands herself to be. Now, folks, bottom line at 600 times, this is tragic. This person and all those other people, again, it's like, you just want to hold them and say, it's going to be okay. You know, you're fine. It's the same thing with the trans people. And it largely is the same condition. It is a body identity dysphoria. And that's the name for these people. It's called body integrity identity disorder, that their mind is not integrous, is in integrity with what their mind and their body is. And so it's the same kind of thing. These people need great compassion, great tenderness, but we can't play along with it because it really doesn't help things at all. So what do we do with this? We don't fall for the illusion, because it doesn't help anybody. And we need to know this literature, and we need to be confident and just say, you know what, this is just bunk, it's bunk. And again, it's not because I go to Little Pinecone Baptist out on the highway and I'm just a traditionalist, you know. The best literature, and I, you know, speaking to your opponent, and I would assume you being a smart person would be very familiar with this literature, you know. It says the exact opposite. And so if we want to be in line in our school, in our school district, in our community, if we want to be in line with what science says, then we should consider these things. If we want to be contrary to what much of the science says, because there is articles that make their case, but the bulk of it makes our case, and we should be very confident about that and know that this exists in the mind and the mind of the individual, and solely in the mind of the individual. And that's not nothing for the individual, but it shouldn't drive the behavior of everybody else, right? So, next session, we're going to talk about one of my favorite subjects, and that is loving our LGBT neighbor in grace and truth, doing this in a compassionate way while still standing for truth. So,
this by dueling mics, Matt.
Yes.
One of the things you need to really catch here, I don't know why his mic isn't working right, but I think it's the snarky thing, really.
It's my mom is shutting it off.
Don't miss the fact now that he's making a comparison and saying this. If we won't cut off that person's leg because we have no scientific, no, then why would we cut off or remove other parts for a transgender? Got it?
Yes, absolutely.
If you haven't purchased a copy of this book before,